magazine, where he also writes about baseball. A collection of his baseball articles from 1977 to 81 has just been published under the title Late Innings, A Baseball Companion. His other books on baseball include The Summer Game and Five Seasons. A collection of his short stories is published under the title The Stone Arbor. Roger Angel, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
I'd like to ask you to begin for us by reading an excerpt of your book.
Okay, this is part of the very first chapter. All ball players are connected with each other through the record books, of course, but now they seem connected to me as well through this enveloping, delicate capillary network of memory and association. Baseball is in my blood. When I stop to think about the sport this way, to think about how much almost every fan comes to know almost without effort, I'm reminded of my earliest feelings about baseball when I'd just begun to follow the fortunes of my first real heroes, Joe DiMaggio and Carl Hubble, through the long summers of my teens. Even then, I must have sensed that more was involved in baseball than the accomplishments of a few athletes and teams, that I was now attached in a rather mysterious way to a larger structure, to something deep and rooted, with its own history, customs, records, honored and dishonored warriors, founders, superstitions, and clouded lore. I belonged and I cared, and because I've been lucky enough to go on caring, I've belonged to baseball now for almost half of its history. For me, going through the baseball record books and picture books is like opening a family album stuffed with old letters, wedding invitations, tattered newspaper clippings, graduation programs, and curled-up, darkening snapshots. Here are people from my own branches of the family, the Giants, the Red Sox, the first Mets, and in among them, page after page, the names and looks of other departed, almost forgotten in-laws and cousins and visitors. Everyone is here, the White Elephants and the Gas House Gang and the Big Red Machine, Hank Aaron and Hank Greenberg, Clemente and Brooksy, Gabby and Pie and Sonny Jim, Doc Kramer. Why do I always think of Doc Kramer the instant I think of Sonny Jim Bottomley? Because, each in his own league, they were the same kind of players, invaluable, indestructible, and somehow never quite famous. Because each of them got six hits in a single game and did it twice. No one else has ever done that. Harvey Keene, Willie and Duke and the Mick, Jackie Robinson, Frank Robinson, Country Slaughter, Catfish Hunter, Columbia Lou, Old Biscuit Pants, and the Fordham Flash. Oh, those bases on balls. Stan the Man, the Meal Ticket, Schoolboy Row, the Yankee Clipper, Ron Swoboda sliding on his face. Bill Clem, an umpire, yes. He spent 5,000 afternoons on the field, far more than anyone else in baseball history, and invented the umpire's essential creed. In my heart, I never called one wrong. The Babe, the Dutchman, Christy Mathewson, Frank Chance, the peerless leader, the Big Train, Cap Anson, an Iliad of names. Many of these players, of course, were before my time, but I've noticed that this makes very little difference to me now. I've read so much about the old-timers and heard older players and writers and fans, including my father, talk about them so often that they're almost as visible to me as the stars I've watched on the field.
Thanks. It's Roger Angel reading from his new collection of articles on baseball called Late Innings. You mentioned feeling connected to this great lore, American lore. I wonder if you think that most people who've spent a lot of time writing about baseball still feel that, you know, personally caught up in the whole mythology of baseball, or maybe a lot of writers get jaded and cynical.
Yeah, I think so, Terry, because for one thing, if you think about it, the game has changed so little. The game as it's played, it really is the same game that we watched when we were kids, and it's the same games that our parents watch if they watch baseball. So you do get a sense watching a ball game, this strange feeling that this batter, this contemporary ball player, is not only playing against this particular pitcher, this particular team, but he is batting against all pitchers who ever pitched. And since everything he does and everything that happens in every ball game is written down, this is what stats are for. The non-fans don't understand that, but it's not just for this particular game or this particular season. It is because every part of every baseball game is connected to every other game that was played, and no other sport has that comeliness, you know.
I get the feeling that you really love the Baseball Encyclopedia. That it's, do you just pick it up and read from it?
Oh, I do. Yeah, I often, if I'm writing a piece, I go to it to find something out or to confirm something, and then I find that I've spent 40 minutes just moving around in it and remembering old names and averages, and all fans use it. It's a wonderful edition. It's fairly new. You know, it's only about 10 years old, and. It's a wonderful adjunct to the sport.
What are the other like things or objects or books that you have, either contemporary things or things from your past or baseball's past that you keep around and refer to? And
well, there are official records of baseball. There's the baseball yearbook every year, which has all of the records and numbers and news of the previous season. At the beginning of the year, the first sign of spring really is the arrival from each league of the American League Red Book and the National League Green Book, which has the spring training lineups, and plus last year's figures. There are permanent record books, and then there are brand new reference books. There was a new one by Joe Reichler, just came out in the last year, which has a wonderful new way of looking at records. Baseball's literature is growing very fast. There's a brand new book by a man named Bill James, a statistician, who is a serious statistician and a serious baseball addict, who has added a lot of new statistics to the game that we'll all have to think about and perhaps add to our permanent stock of figures like that.
Phenomenon that I've noticed amongst music listeners is that people tend to always remember most vividly, I think, the musicians who were popular when the listener was, say, 15 through 21. It seems to be like the formative years for forming your musical taste. And I think maybe that's true with baseball, too, that people's
sure.
baseball heroes are formed at a certain age.
Yeah.
Do you ever get, like, nostalgic for baseball of your youth? Or you say the game
well,
hasn't changed
well, I do.
Much,
I, once in a while, I stop and think about people. I mentioned Joe DiMaggio and Carl Hubbell. Those are people from my teens, from my early teens, when they first arrived. And Hubbell was established in baseball when I became a fan of his. I remember when Joe DiMaggio arrived. And so I saw him through a whole career. I can see both of those players. I can see Hubbell pitching, DiMaggio batting and running and throwing with absolute clarity. It sometimes requires more effort for me to think of players whom I admired just a few years ago. It's easier to go back that far. And I guess DiMaggio is the best ball player I ever saw.
Do you ever imagine yourself playing?
Not
being
so
a
much anymore.
Player?
Well, I'm 61 and I don't do that much anymore. When I did, I was a pitcher in my dreams, and I would go through lineups and strike people out. But also, I've learned so much about baseball. I mean, I don't know anything, like everything about baseball at all. I'm still learning a lot, but I have learned how hard it is. And this is the great thing to drive out dreams of striking out the side. I've learned how hard it is to strike out one man, and I've heard pitchers talk about how they work on batters. This is the other side of baseball that is really more important to me than its associations and its memories is the constant discovery of how hard the game is. If the game were easy, it wouldn't hold us the way it does.
Well, there's lots of other things that are difficult. Can you figure out why you like baseball more than the other difficult things?
Well, you can see the difficulty of baseball. For one thing, it looks easy at first glance. Everybody, it's one of the great attractions that brings people in, at least young men. They say, well, I could have done this. I'm almost this good. But as you stay with it, as you begin to watch it over a period of time, you see that it is the most intensely difficult of all popular sports, I think. It's not as violent as others. I don't think that some of its movements are as graceful in a wild way as basketball, or it's not as loose and free as basketball. But I think most athletes are agreed that hitting a pitch ball is the hardest single thing to do in any sport. And just in the last year, I've begun to learn how hard it is. I did a whole piece on hitting that is in this book. It's a long chapter on hitting called One Hard Way to Make a Living, which is one of the ball players said to me in a very discouraged voice when we began talking about how you hit, what to do, what happens between the pitcher and the batter. And I'd always thought that since baseball does look so visible, since it seems clear even if you're in the bleachers, you can see what's happening. I thought I understood it until I really began to talk to hitters, and I was astounded at the difficulty of it. And the fact that most batters give up most of the plate if they're up against a good pitcher. They say, well, anything out there is his. I'm going to try to anything that comes in these 4 inches in here, that's my area. I'll do my best against that. And pitchers know that. As I wrote in here, I think pitchers always seem more optimistic and cheerful than batters, and batters always think that the odds are too great, that they're loaded against them.
I think the last thing that the pitcher who you interview says in that article is the best feeling is walking up to the pitcher's mound knowing you're feared.
No, the batter said that.
The batter says that.
That was Ted Simmons, who had taught himself to be a cleanup hitter, number four hitter, and who was a wonderful, wonderful man talking about hitting. And saying that and if late in the game, if there are men on base, and you walk up and know that you're feared, this is the greatest feeling. I mean, he described this in very sensual terms, you know.
I can't remember if it's him or someone else who also gives the advice to other batters to really crowd the base, to stand really close to it, so there's very little room between the batter and the base.
Some old-time hitters said that if they had it to do over again, they would crowd the plate because it makes so much trouble for the pitcher. It almost takes away. The pitcher starts thinking, what is he doing up there so close to the plate?
But don't you hurt yourself?
Well, it takes guts. It really does. The great plate crowder, perhaps of all time, is Frank Robinson, who is now the Giants' manager, and he would stand right up on top of the plate. And there's in the chapter I have here on Bob Gibson, who was this fearsome intimidator on the mound, and he admired Robinson because he stood in so close, and he said. That made the pitchers think, and some of them thought, well, he doesn't want the pitch inside, so they put the pitch inside, and he would kill it. That's where he wanted. it's a personal duel out there between the pitcher and the batter, and it's a deadly war. It really is, and a lot of courage is involved. None of the contemporary hitters I talked to said that they were afraid, but the ones who were ever afraid. They said, never, no, never. But when the ones I talked to who were out of baseball, one of them said, of course they're afraid. Of course I was afraid. And he said, I played in the major leagues 9 years, scared to death. So fear comes into it.
Where do you get the best sense of that tension that's developed between the batter and the pitcher? You know, either which part of the park or do you
feel
it more
on television?
Well,
if you're lucky enough to get somewhere near the plate, this is the only advantage really to being in the press box is that you're pretty close to the plate and you can see what is being thrown. You can see what the pitcher is doing. And if you get a first-class pitcher who really has a variety of pitches, isn't just a young thrower, as they say, who is throwing a pattern of pitches, then you can begin to understand this. Because each pitch really has something to do with the previous pitch and the one that's coming next. It's part of a pattern, and you get the batter leaning outside a little bit, then come in under his hands. Some pitchers are wonderful to watch. Well, the best I ever saw for this was Catfish Hunter because he didn't throw hard, but he would work two or three innings to establish to get a right-handed batter thinking in under his hands, and he'd have pitches just on the black, just in the strike zone, or just off, just in under his hands. And once that was established, then everything would then every second or third or fourth pitch would be out in the outside corner. So pretty soon the batter was swinging and was swaying back and forth like the Bandarlog with Ka the Python. I always get that feeling if in the Jungle Book, if a great pitcher is working, that pretty soon the batters are swaying back and forth helplessly. It's a wonderful thing to see when it's established. Tommy John does that too.
You know, another. Almost a competition, I think, that happens is between the person and their own pain to see which is going to get the better of which, the person or the pain. You quote, I forget which pitcher it is, who said in his own memoirs that when his arm was bad, it felt like an alligator had chewed at it.
Yeah, it was Jim Boughton said that it was felt alligators were chewing at his elbow. Yeah, it's most
That's a
pitchers.
Horrible image.
Most pitchers pitch in pain, at least after the middle of the season. They're hurting a lot. It's an unnatural thing to put this much strain on people's arms, and they're always blowing out their arms. Pitchers have a very dangerous existence in another sense, which is that their arm may go out at any time, and then they're really finished, or else they have to painful rehabilitation and come back as a different kind of a pitcher.
Is it expected, you think, of pitchers and of other players who've maybe pulled a tendon in their leg or something that they should really overcome the pain and how are they supposed to?
I don't think so much. I think that nowadays, I mean, this was the old school of put a little tobacco juice on it and go back out there. But nowadays, there's much more awareness of the kind of injury you can do to yourself, and you can be lost to a team for several weeks, and I don't think that this is as much admired as it used to be.
Let me introduce you. I'm speaking with Roger Angel, and his new collection of baseball writing is called Late Innings. And I'd like to ask you to read another selection from it, and we've got something all earmarked, and this has to do with relating to the game as a fan. This is again from Roger Angel's new book, Late Innings.
I wrote it in one of my spring pieces. Baseball is simple but never easy. Each year, just before spring comes, I begin to wonder if I shouldn't give up this game. Surely it must be time for me to cut short my abiding, summer-consuming preoccupation with scores and standings and averages, and to put an end to all those evenings and weekend hours given to the tube and morning hours given to the sports pages. Is there no cure for this secondhand passion, which makes me a partner, however unwilling, in the blather of publicity, the demeaning emptiness of hero worship, and the inconceivably wasteful outpourings of money and energy that we give to professional sports now? I would happily avoid ever again having to watch the beery rage of a losing crowd in some dirty big city stadium on a sweltering night in August, or, just as bad, suddenly noticing across the room the patronizing stare of some baseball hater, a certified adult, when he hears me mention Reggie or Yaz or Willie, and watches me wave my hands and take up a stance at a make-believe plate while I tell some friends about what I've just seen or once saw and how they should have been there too. Each year I think about such things, often in the middle of the night, and I groan and I say to myself, yes, all right, this is the last year for me, no more baseball after this. But then, a few weeks, days or weeks later, back in the sun in Arizona or Florida in March, I change my mind. This is the thoughts that came to me when I was watching a pitcher called Larry Sorensen talking to some little leaguers in Arizona. None of Larry Sorensen's talk to the West Side little leaguers at Sun City was exactly new to me, but it made me feel cheerful and instructed to hear it. I think I'm almost too old for baseball, but every year I find that I need to go on learning it. Most of all, I think, baseball disarms us.
Have there been things recently that have made you think, oh, I'm gonna stop being a baseball fan and give it up?
Well, it's always in the back of my mind. I think most real fans feel that way because of the struggles with the owners and because particularly the new owners have just come into the game and don't have much feeling for it and much sense of what it is, who view it as entertainment and don't sense the difference between sports and entertainment, which is a considerable difference, of course. And then there's been so much off-the-field news and publicity and self-aggrandizement. Someone like George Steinbrenner makes me think about giving up baseball almost every day. But people care about it so much, and I hear from so many people write me letters about their baseball feelings. I get a stream of baseball letters all through the year, so much that I can't begin to answer them all. And from people who were still connected with the game. So if people are attached in that serious way, it is serious. I don't think it's just childish and boyish to go on with this. It rewards me. It's a special feeling. And as I've written again and again, it more and more feels to me like an enormous family that we all belong to. And those of us who are in it, I think, sense the disapproval and even the anger of the non-fan. But I think, Terry, there's a lot of envy there, too. They want to belong, too.
Oh, they belong to other things, probably.
Sure.
Well, there's so many different families like that. You know, there's music and baseball.
Sure.
And I guess theater's like that, too.
Absolutely.
For a lot of people.
Absolutely, yeah.
You said that there's a difference between sports and entertainment and, you know, particularly big money entertainment. Well, how does sports as entertainment change the way people or fans relate to the players and to
the
game?
The owners who think that sports, that baseball, no, let's talk about baseball. I think that baseball is just entertainment, and a lot of people say that. And Howard Cosell says this all the time. Sports is just another part of the entertainment business. I don't think that they really have thought about it, or else they've forgotten what the special nature of sport is. I mean, obviously, in any serious professional sport or amateur sport, we don't know the outcome. This is the crucial difference. The first place, we don't know what's going to happen. That's what we come for, to see what's going to happen. The outcome cannot be guaranteed, which is why there should be boring games and one-sided games and laughers. They're all very important. because these help build up your anticipation, your knowledge that great game is coming. And there aren't many great games in baseball, and there shouldn't be. The entertainers want every game to be a great game, and they always want you to come away with a sense that you have won. This is what Mr. Steinbrenner wants. He wants the fans always to win. That's all he cares about. Winning isn't that important. Of course, it's wonderful to win, but you have to have lost first in order to win. And then the wonderful thing about baseball and the defining of what sport is the presence of an expert audience, of the fans there who can watch a game being played. I think the most significant sound in baseball is the fan who is there watching his own team and calls out to somebody on his team coming out to bat and says, come on, you bum. Now, that says it all. He knows the guy he's cheering for is no good. He isn't good enough. He doesn't have much hope that he's going to come through. He wants him to come through, but at the same time, he's critical enough to know that he isn't good enough to play this game very well. That's what the records are for. That's what stats are for. We can tell how good everybody is. And it's the presence of this expert audience that in a sense makes it into a ritual, which makes it more significant. And so when something is done well, we not only are pleased, but we approve. There's a sense of approval to what we've seen. And this connects us with the past, and it connects us, as all sport really does, with our own species. This is why we're watching.
In trying to make all games the big entertainment where everybody walks away a winner, do the announcers play into that? Do you think that the announcers are chosen now to...
Well, there's a great range of announcers, and there are some new announcers, some young ones, and some of them are ballplayers who are really terrific. They're really good, and they're telling us a lot about the game that the old announcers didn't bother to or didn't know enough to tell them. And some of the old ones were good, too. Ernie Harwell of the Tigers is a wonderful announcer, and he's been around for years. Ned Martin of the Red Sox is one of the very best, and I learn a lot listening to people like that. The networks tend to over-report because they're not comfortable with something on the tube that isn't talked about a lot. And there should be silence while you watch. There should be long intervals of silence because baseball explains itself quite readily what happens on the field. You don't need a lot of explanation. You can see it. And since television is uncomfortable with silence, they tend to fill up the waiting pause while the count goes up on a batter. They insert a picture of that batter up in the right-hand corner and is telling him about his sore shoulder or his contract negotiations or his troubled marriage or his struggle with drugs. And I go crazy watching this. And a lot of other fans do, too. A lot of fans turn off the set and sometimes turn on a radio where they don't do as much of this and keep the radio in the background and have the pictures of the two, but particularly for network TV of baseball.
To have that family feeling and to feel like you're either winning or losing, you have to have allegiance to a team, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Who is your allegiance to?
The Red Sox, most of all. The Red Sox are my team, and the Mets and the National League. And I used to be a Yankees fan when I was a kid, a Yankees and a Giants fan. But the Yankees won too much. It was just not very interesting. It was debilitating. And I switched to the Red Sox because
I don't think Philadelphians understand that.
Well, of course they do. It's the same thing. I mean, the only trouble with the Phillies now is that you have won, which sets up a whole new set of problems. I came on a quotation not long ago, which I think perfectly covers the problem of the Phillies fan. I think it's by George Bernard Shaw, who said, "There are two tragedies in life. One is never to get your heart's desire. The other is to get it." And Phillies, now having gotten their heart's desire, have experienced the second after knowing the first so well when the Phillies won the pennant, of course.
Well, the Red Sox are from Boston, and you live in New York.
Well, I sort of came aboard, I think, in 67 when they won an extraordinary pennant, and wonderful pennant that raced in the American League that year. And also, I have family in New England, and I have a house in the summer and a cottage I go to in Maine, which is deep in the heart of Red Sox territory. And the Red Sox have been very good for a long period of time, but never quite good enough. In my lifetime, they've never won the World Championship. There have been three pennants that I can remember. And that's just about right. I mean, there's a lot of suffering and a lot of pleasure. There's a really wonderful sort of philosophical question, because the Red Sox fans suffer so much, is whether the Red Sox do this because they're in New England, or whether New England did it to them, made them the perfect team that represents a sense, sort of a Calvinist sense of doom and suffering. But
you know the expression that you don't choose your family.
Yeah,
you know, you're born
exactly.
You mean you're not supposed to choose your team. You're kind of born into it from
where
you grow
up,
right?
But people do this quite quickly. You know, they're very loyal, devoted fans of some of the new expansion teams. I know some Seattle fans, for instance, who were real fans and care a lot. And their team has never done anything yet, but someday it will. And when it happens, then they're preparing themselves now. But you have to belong. There is a wonderful line written by a Boston columnist, not a sports columnist, who said it all. You have to belong to a team. You can't admire this game in the abstract, belong to it in the abstract. And this guy, Mike Barnicle, once wrote, baseball is not a life and death matter, but the Red Sox are. And that's exactly right. Exactly right.
Let me reintroduce you again. Roger Angel is my guest. He's senior fiction editor at The New Yorker, where he also writes about baseball, and a new collection of his baseball writing from 1977 to 1981 has just been published under the title Late Innings. You have a really interesting piece that's included in the book about a couple. You start a correspondence with a woman who's a baseball fan and whose lover ended up joining the minor leagues. And you say you went out there to watch them just to see what baseball was like away from television and fame and big money and all this. Would you tell us a little bit about what?
Well, her name is Linda Kittle, and she's a wonderful writer. And I began in among this masses of baseball letters. I began getting letters about 4 or 5 years ago from her. And when the man she lives with, Ron Goble, a tall, thin pitcher, was pitching at the Class A level, which is the lowest level of organized ball, just about for a moribund team called the Boise Buckskins. And she wrote wonderful letters from out there and then continued to write after the end of that season. He had a bad year. Ron had a terrible year. The Buckskins folded at the end of that year. But her letters about what she felt about baseball and what she felt about Ron and what Ron felt in the middle of this, trying to find out rather late in his life whether he had the makings of a professional player, were very moving. And I wrote back, and we set up a correspondence, and then they moved to Vermont, and he began playing semi-pro ball. And then 2 years ago, suddenly he came down with cancer, and which has been arrested. He's okay. And then he resumed playing semi-pro ball. And last year I went up finally and met them, which is like meeting someone in your family again. I felt as if I knew them very well. And they took me in, not just into their team, but sort of into their lives. And I stayed with them for a week. And I found other people. They introduced me to other people in Vermont who with a very strong affiliation with baseball, sort of a lifetime commitment to baseball. There was one man named Larry Brown up there who was a asbestos miner and a taciturn, shy New Englander who was absolutely dedicated to baseball and has spread baseball among kids in the Vermont hills there. And there are a lot of little teams, little league teams and Babe Ruth league teams that are playing because of him. And he had very strong feelings about contemporary ball players and their connection with old-time ball players and with country ball players he'd known when he was trying to play ball himself. So I began to feel, although this was during the strike, and I did not go out looking for anti-matter to the strike. I was going to do this story anyway, but I suddenly began to feel that, well, baseball is okay. It's not just in the hands of a few 26 wealthy men who forced this strike at the top level. It means a lot to different people. And I'm still in touch with Ron and Linda. I talked to Linda on the phone just about 3 days ago, and the semi-pro league is starting up again up there, and he'll be in the bullpen this year. This is the Burlington A's, Burlington, Vermont A's. And actually, I didn't have it in the book, but although their team was not very good, they won their local pennant last year. I think maybe it helped them. Maybe the celebrity of my writing about them helped. I like to think so. But
was viewing the game any more or less fulfilling because you knew one of the players in a different way than you do?
I was very anxious when he pitched. I felt like a, you know, as if you were a relative, as if you were a son, as if you were a brother or something. Sure, you care more if someone you know is involved. And I was sitting with Linda, who was dying whenever Ron was out on the field, of terrible anxiety. But actually, I began to pull for the Buckskins right away because I met the players, I met the young manager and all this. And you pick this up right away. You begin to care about a team. I can watch a Sandlot game, and if I watch four or five innings, I'm decided which team without even quite knowing why I'm for one of the teams. Maybe because I like the way one player plays.
You've mentioned the strike a few times. Do you think that the bitterness a lot of baseball fans felt last year is still residual now?
I think it's still there. There is a lot of bitterness among fans directed toward baseball, and during the strike, the noticeable thing about the fans was, at least the ones I heard from and talked to, so as they didn't care who was right, who was wrong. They felt that the game had been taken away from them, and it had been. The fans were the big victims of the strike last year. I had strong feelings that on the side of the players in the strike, because I knew and know to this moment, I mean, it's absolutely true that the strike was forced by the owners. They made it happen. It was a attempt at pure muscle. They tried to break the free agency, take it back from the players, and they failed. And they did not succeed in this. But I think that the open warfare between the players and the owners will now probably won't happen again. The group of owners who it wasn't all of them. It's a mistake to think, as we do, that the owners are a united group. They're not. They're quite different people among them. The more liberal group will now have a stronger hand, I think, in the game. But the big change, I think, in baseball now, the feelings of the fans toward the connection of the fan toward the players has been permanently altered mostly by the very large salaries that the players are getting, these enormous salaries. I thought it was fine that players began getting more money. I sense the social irony of paying all this money to ballplayers. We shouldn't be doing it, but that's not the fault of the players. It isn't even the fault of the owners. It's the way we organize things in our society. We seem to do this. Once you accept that, then if we can accept it, then I'd just as soon have the players get the money, because they're the ones who were playing the game. But this, in turn, since the average big league salary is now $200,000 a year, about that, the average, that is, and there are stars getting over $1 million, some almost $2 million a year, the players have become celebrities because of the money they earn rather than for what they do. And we can't identify with them. We can't say, that could be me, that is me out there. There's an awe of them. We want to know all about their private lives. And instead of thinking, what is it like to hit the fastball or to strike out a man with the bases loaded, we think, what is it like to have $750,000 a year? It's a terrible distraction, and there's so much that goes on that takes us away from our original purpose in going to the game, which is to watch this beautiful game played by these marvelously gifted young men. We're always being distracted, I try to remind myself why I go there in the first place, and sometimes I have tried to stay away from the inside locker room story, because that is not the point. I enjoy a lot of these players a lot. I've gotten to know them. I think they're terrific. Some of them are terrific. Some of them are far from terrific. There's the same proportion of knaves and idiots and heroes that we find in any other line of work, I think. But people say to me, what is Reggie really like? They said, I'm asked this all the time, and I say, he's the best October slugger I ever saw. When the game is on the line late in the year, I'd love to watch him. And my friends look at me as if I was an idiot, and they say, that's not the question. And I say, yes, it is. That is the question. And what Reggie thinks about the salt talks is not the question. And he'll tell you, too.
If people are free agents, does that affect the family nature of baseball? For instance, okay, we've talked about how you say baseball's like a family, and you don't choose your family. You're born into it, and most people root for the team of the area that they grew up in or that they live in. But the players, they go where they please, or they go at the best place that'll have them. And, you know, the fans are kind of stuck with the team of their city, but the players go back and forth.
Yeah, fans are bruised all the time. They have to put up with a lot. I mean, there was a period when I was writing about baseball in the 60s when not just the players were leaving, but teams were leaving. Teams were abandoning cities, and it happened a lot. If you think about the Braves, I mean, they left Boston, went to Milwaukee, won some championships, then left Milwaukee, went to Atlanta.
I remember really confused when the Giants left.
It was
frightful. How can a team leave?
I couldn't believe it. It was terrible. But fans just have to put up with it. There's nothing else they can do. I think that a team like the Yankees strains this almost to the breaking point. I'm serious. I think that the Yankees probably have lost a lot of true fans because there isn't enough continuity from one year to the next, even in one season. The Yankees now have seven players on the team of 25 who weren't there at the beginning of April. And this is too much. This is an owner who wants to present an entertainment. He wants a team that will doesn't matter who they are as long as they can win. As I said before,
let me reintroduce you. Roger Angel is my guest, and his new collection of baseball writing is called Late Innings. One of your pieces is about women sports writers and the difficulties that they've had being accepted not only by the sports writers but by the managers and by the players, the difficulty of even getting into the locker room and doing the story. What's like legally the status of that now?
Well, this has changed now, Terry. This came about. There was a suit brought against organized baseball by a woman with Sports Illustrated, Melissa Ludke. She represented a lot of other women as well who had gone into sports writing because they were interested. They are professional journalists and love sports. They were not allowed to go into the clubhouse after the game because the ballplayers were taking off their clothes. And baseball took a very prim, almost moral attitude about this. And the commissioner, when he enforced this ruling, said, well, and he talked about the sanctity of the American home. He really did, as if there was, and there was a strong suggestion that from everybody in baseball, from the writers as well, from the old writers, that older writers particularly, that the women wanted to go in there so they could ogle the naked athletes. It was a very strange phenomenon, and these women, in the piece, I quote them at great length of what they went through. They suffered really extraordinarily. It's a very bitter sort of thing to be told that you can't pursue your profession for something, for a distracting thing like this. And, of course, the reasons that this seems so shocking to the established world of baseball, which is very conservative, was very interesting. As I went into this and I talked to some of my friends in the press box, men whom I knew and admired and knew to be liberals and intelligent, and even they thought, no, it shouldn't happen, and they would begin to talk really right out of their unconscious about how they first came to baseball, and they used to go to the game with their father, their mothers didn't come. Sports, you know, is very complicated. It goes very deep into our national psyche, and there's something about the sexual side of sports that is never discussed very much. Athletes are separated from women at a very early age. If you're any good, then you become a kind of a hero. And a lot of athletes think about women as cheerleaders, really, and those are the ones they marry. And they divide them up into the good girls whom they marry who stay at home and the bad girls whom they shack up with on the road. And then there are no other women. And a lot of the athletes, a lot of the ballplayers had never met a professional woman, a woman who was pursuing a profession until they met some of these sports writers. And they changed their view. The problem really wasn't with the athletes. They adjusted very quickly. It was with the front office. And it was with the other writers.
Well, one of the...
Some of the writers, not all by any means.
You quote a sports columnist who said, well, you know, when do I get my equal rights? When do I get to go interview Chrissy Everett,
yes. Well, that's...
What do you say to that?
Well, that isn't the point. I mean, it isn't the point. I mean, that's a loaded question because it suggests that women, as I just said, it's because women are doing it because they want to see men naked. But the dismaying thing was that when I began to write this story, and I began to write because I'd seen a couple of these women that I knew, I'd seen how they were suffering, and I thought this was a real story. But a lot of my colleagues made the same joke, and I said, "You don't understand. This is serious. It really is." I wasn't being glum about it, but it was a real matter of sexism and prejudice and exclusionary practices, and they only saw it as a joke. Very peculiar thing. Very strange. Sports is male and macho to an extraordinary degree still, and we want to keep it that way, or some part of us does.
Yeah, how do you feel about that personally? You know, being a part of the family and the mythology of baseball.
Well, baseball is a male sport. So far, there have been no professional women been able to play it. It's a peculiar thing. It doesn't bother me because it isn't a male sport in the sense that it is violent. it isn't a sport of enormous strength. It's a sport of speed, dexterity, quickness above all. I'm bothered by this sometimes. I wish it were a sport that women could play as well. But aside from this kind of sexism that goes all through all sports, it doesn't bother me that much, because actually there are so many women who are true baseball fans who know as much about the game as the men do and really belong to it in the same sense that we've been talking about.
Have the fans changed at all, like in the parks? You know how people complain about it in movie theaters, everybody talks through the movie and they're never cleaned anymore. Your feet stick to the floor. Is the equivalent in baseball now?
Well, I don't think that the parks are dirty. Maybe they are. I guess they are. But a lot of ballparks are much more violent and much more drunken than they used to be. It's a terrible problem in some cities. Yankee Stadium at certain times is just frightful. If the team is losing, there are certain nights. It's just terrible. I mean, I don't want to sit in the stands. I stopped wanting to bring my wife and my son, my young son, to the ballparks under those conditions. There's a lot of violence and drunkenness. I think a lot of it comes from outside. I don't think it's engendered by the game. It's a societal problem, and people come to the parks drunk. But I think that there is a rage in the crowd that is maybe contributed to by the size of the salaries and by the fact that the envy of young fans for these men out there who were really in quite a different world than they are. And somebody like Steinbrenner, who was always demeaning and belittling his players and treating them like children, invites this. This is a form of saying to the fan, it's okay, because we expect nothing but victory from our players. We expect them to do nothing. They must always win. They must always come through. And you can't do that in baseball. It's guaranteed. I mean, if you succeed as a batter one-third of the time, you're batting 300, and that puts you among the elite. If your team wins 6 out of 10, you've got a pennant. But that means the other 4 you're going to lose. But if you have an owner that's encouraging these expectations, when they don't come through, then the fans want to throw things. They want to feel that they own these players because they're getting so much salaries, that the salaries are so high. These people belong to us now, which is a new feeling and one that makes for rage and hostility.
Do you think the players feel more pressure on them because the salaries?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a good question, Tara, because there is a popular feeling in baseball, in the front office and among the old former ball players and managers and writers, and among a lot of fans, that the players don't try as hard anymore because of these salaries, that they've got it made. If you're getting $600,000 a year and you have a 4-year contract, why try? You've got it made. I don't think it's that way at all. I think it's exactly the opposite. What motivates a professional athlete, or at least baseball players, is pride. That's how they get there. This is how they can do this thing over and over again, because they want to look good. They want to succeed. They hate it when they fail. And in baseball, you fail a lot, and they suffer. They don't like them. And if they're getting all this money, they want to do better. They're aware of it. They're aware of the fans' expectations. And so you get a 280 hitter or a 290 hitter wants to be a 320 hitter or a 330 hitter. If he's hit 20 home runs, he wants to hit 40 home runs, and he begins to play worse. There's no doubt about it. I think this is what's happened to George Foster in New York with the Mets, who's had off to the worst start of his career because he signed with the Mets for almost $2 million. And he himself says, I'm trying too hard. It's very hard to play this game under the best of conditions, and when you hype it in this way, it makes for poorer performances sometimes.
One of the practices that baseball players have engaged in for many years is testimonials for commercial products, endorsements.
Yeah.
And it seems, though, that now, it used to be, I think, that a player would be associated with, like, a specific product, maybe a hair cream or something.
Yeah.
But now you're able to do, like, you know, 5 or 10 things in one season,
yeah.
Endorse, like, hundreds of products. How does it make you feel when you see a player who you really respect doing an endorsement? Do you feel one way or another about it?
I don't care about the players do it. I really don't. It doesn't bother me. It bothers me a little bit still to see Joe DiMaggio doing Mr. Coffee or because I guess because I have my leftover boyish feelings of hero worship about him. What I don't like is to see baseball itself do this. And the commissioner has let this happen. There's a lot of schlock in baseball, and it shouldn't happen. It's ridiculous. There are more and more awards given out through the year now, and commercial firms grab off these awards and connect themselves. The award for the best relief pitching in baseball is now given by the Rolaids company. You get it, Rolaids for relief, and this just makes my skin creep. It's horrible. I mean, old Bowie never should have done it. It's just dumb. It detracts from the sport, and there isn't enough money to make from the Rolaids company to make it worthwhile.
What's the publicity like that you get, the press kits?
Well, there isn't much of that. There are other sports do a lot more of that. You don't get press kits, really. You get, if you go to the game, if you sit in the press box, you get a folder with a lot of stats and a lot of news about who is pitching tonight and what happened his last outing, several pages of mimeograph stuff and stats from around the league, what happened in the other games and what happened in the minor league clubs of that particular team. There isn't publicity, and it isn't like a press folder you get from a major studio or something like that. The league send out sort of canned press releases that are fairly boring. I think they're not particularly good, but there isn't the out and out flogging of the product so far. I think there may be more because this is, again, the owners who want to bring the game up to date, make it more modern, make it faster, all of this sort of thing. More publicity is something that they're instinctively attuned to.
Is there a lot of camaraderie amongst the baseball writers?
Yeah, I think so. Sure, it's a hard life. I mean, I'm just a visiting baseball writer. I work hard for a week or two, and sort of overall, at the end of the year, and I go to the playoffs and the World Series, of course, and then follow a particular series or team that I'm interested in. But then I go away and I do something else. But beat writers, ones on the beat, are hardworking people, and they travel with the team, and it's a long season. It's really tough, and it's hard to write about baseball every year and all through the year, and sometimes several stories a day, and to keep some evidence of quality and objectivity. Very tough. I admire them a lot. I think they're much better than they used to be. Mm-hmm. Everybody talks about the old-time greats, and there are some wonderful old baseball writers, but by and large, today's baseball writers are much better informed. They write better. They're more intelligent. They're more involved in every level of the game.
Roger Angel is my guest, senior fiction editor at The New Yorker, and he also writes about baseball. A collection of his writing from 1977 to 81 has just been published under the title Late Innings. There is quite a body of baseball fiction and baseball literature. What are your favorites within there? And also, if there are any baseball movies that you like a lot, I'd like to hear it.
There haven't been many good baseball movies to start with the back of the question. The one I like best, I guess, is Bang the Drum Slowly, which was made from one of Mark Harris's good baseball novels. And in some way, they were able to get some actors who could throw, which has always been the main problem. The two big problems about making a baseball movie, if you think about it, is getting actors who can throw. You can simulate batting, I think, and you can get ones who can run. But I can remember the old ones from the 30s and 40s, and they had Gary Cooper playing Babe Ruth, and he couldn't throw. He couldn't. It was pathetic. And now and then he had to throw, and I love Gary Cooper, but he never looked like a ball player. And Bill Bendix didn't move like a ball player either. And the extras didn't look like ball players. But Bang the Drum Slowly has some people who in the background who can run and throw, and has a wonderful performance by Robert De Niro as the doomed catcher. Good baseball movie. And those Mark Harris novels, the Southpaw, particularly the first one I liked best, are among my favorites, certainly, of baseball fiction. And I would have to mention Bernard Malamud's The Natural, which is a wonderful baseball novel, although perhaps not about baseball itself. It's another kind of a novel. You could say it's a retelling of the Arthurian legend. But he uses all the metaphors of baseball and it's a very important part of that novel is his awareness of the mystery of time, how time passes in a baseball field where there is no clock, and how the ballplayers are always young. Remain young forever. The fans get older, and everything in the world gets older. But the ballplayers are always young heroes. And in The Natural, the hero suddenly vanishes and becomes, he's taking the place of an earlier hero, and then something is happening to him and he dies, in effect, without knowing it, and becomes somebody replaces him in center field, which is the mystery of baseball, and that the players, and one of the mysteries of it, that they are always young. That's a good book. There's a lot of wonderful nonfiction written in baseball, more and more of it, I think. The quality of baseball writing, as I say, is going up. I guess my favorite baseball nonfiction book is a book called The Glory of Their Times. It came out about, 15 or 20 years ago by a man named Lawrence Ritter, who was the first one to discover that, to realize that there were a lot of the ballplayers from the professional ballplayers from the very early days who were still alive, who had become old men. And in his spare time, he was a professor of economics at NYU, he went out and traveled all around the country and got the earliest players of professional baseball to talk about what it was like. And nobody had come to see them in most cases. And it was a true discovery. And then wonderful stuff. This is where I first realized that Smokey Joe Wood was alive, although at that time, whom I wrote about last year, at that time he was in his 70s. And I went to see Smokey Joe Wood last year and did an article about it. But that's The Glory of Their Times is really a wonderful baseball book. It's still in print, and anybody who is a fan should get hold of that.
Is your passion for baseball and for the literature of baseball understood and accepted by your colleagues at The New Yorker?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure it's understood by ballplayers as well as as by my colleagues. But baseball is perfect. I thought about this a lot. It's the perfect writer's game. It really is. I mean,
well,
there are a lot of other
it?
Good games. Well, if you think about it, it's basketball. I mean, everybody in the Philadelphia area is fascinated with the Sixers right now, and it's a great hockey town. But I wouldn't be able to write anything like the way I write. I'd love to be able to write about basketball and hockey because they're wonderful sports, but they're swirling, and you can't really see a lot of the things that are happening. They're perfect television sports because there's constant motion and beautiful things happen, but so fast that you can't really recall them or bring them back. In baseball is linear. First one thing happens, then another thing happens, then another thing happens. And you can see something start to happen. You can see a pitcher's pitches begin to come up a couple of inches as they cross the plate. And you think, well, he's not going to be there much longer. So the game's going to be broken open. Everything in baseball can be written down. You can keep a shorthand, keep score, and go back later and see how everything happened. And baseball is made up of thousands of details, countless amounts of details, how the ball bounced, how it was gloved, what happened to the throw, what happened to the runner, what happened to the pitch. And when you bring this back, it is like writing. The baseball game is divided into chapters, which are innings, and into sentences and into commas and into exclamation points and dots, trailing off dots. It is very much like writing itself. And the other part of it, of course, is that since time does pass rather slowly at times at a ballpark, there's a lot of waiting. There are baseball games that are flat out boring. There are innings that go by. And this is what people who are not fans can't accept. They say, sometimes it's so boring out there. But this is just like reading. Baseball fans and readers are not afraid of being bored because you know that if you keep going, it's going to get better and suddenly it's going to get terrific or there's a good likelihood. And in the meantime, if you wait, maybe even an idea will occur to you. Something will happen to you while you're there, which is not a direct result of being in the book or in that ballpark. But this is because time has been changed if you read, time is altered for you. If you go to a ball game, time is altered because it moves in a very different way in a ballpark than it does the rest of our day.
Well, I've really enjoyed your book and also really enjoyed hearing you talk about baseball this afternoon. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Roger Angel has been my guest, and if you'd like to read his new book, it's called Late Innings, and it's just been published. Roger Angel is also the senior fiction editor at The New Yorker magazine, and his new book, Late Innings, A Baseball Companion, is just published by Simon & Schuster, and it's a collection of his writing from 1977 to 1981. That's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. It's 4 minutes to 5. All Things Considered is coming up at 5. I want to remind you that next Saturday, June 12th, we'll be at 2 o'clock featuring a special broadcast. On June 12th, there will be a disarmament rally held in Manhattan in conjunction with the disarmament sessions that will be held at the UN. We'll be broadcasting live coverage of this rally. The co-anchor will be Margot Adler, whose reports have been frequently heard on All Things Considered. We'll be hearing the speakers at the rally as well as the performers who will be there. So that's beginning 2 o'clock next Saturday afternoon here on WUHY. I'd also like to call your attention to the fact that next week, throughout the week of the Cool Jazz Festival in Philadelphia, every day at 4 o'clock, we'll be featuring jazz programming here on Fresh Air. Monday, of course, it's the Marian McPartland Piano Jazz Program, and her guest will be pianist John Bunch. Tuesday, we'll be hearing from pianist Dave Brubeck and singer Mel Torme. Wednesday, from trumpeter Witten Marsalis and pianist McCoy Tyner. Thursday, from the late bass player David Eisenstein, this is from the Fresh Air Archives, who used to play with Ornette Coleman, who will be performing in Philadelphia Thursday night. And Friday, well, we're not sure if that will be live or from the Fresh Air Archives, so that's still to be decided. Monday afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, Matthew Lesko will be my guest. You might have heard him on Morning Edition a lot. He's the one who always comes on and tells you what you can get for free from the government, what free publications there are about taxes or different laws that you need to know. So he'll be with us at 2 o'clock. At 2:30, Bill Irwin will be here. He's a dancer and mime who will be giving a workshop at the Painted Bride Art Center. Judy Stein will review museum and gallery shows at 3:40, and of course at 4 o'clock, Marian McPartland, joined by guest pianist John Bunch. So I hope you can be with us. Contributing to today's show was Bill Van Wert. The technical director was Lorraine Aragon. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant for the program. Danny Miller is the associate producer. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good weekend.